Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post, Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm well.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Rolling Stone magazine believes that Zack Snyder was possibly, maybe, sources say, involved in hiring some botnets to help whip up support for the so-called Snyder Cut of Justice League. And they are none too happy about it. In a lengthy, tremendously one-sided piece, the mag gives WB execs space to complain over and over again about how badly they got owned by Zack Snyder. An analytics firm said that perhaps as much as 13% of the pro-Snyder traffic was generated by bots, which means that a mere 87% of the torrent of traffic that convinced WB higher-ups to spend $100 million finishing the film was genuine. And Snyder himself has hinted at being the guy behind all this, but, you know, they don't actually have the goods to come out and say it. They say some guy was working on it, some other guy, you know. But maybe it was him, maybe it wasn't. We do have anonymous sources claiming that Zack Snyder, possibly while twirling his mustache and clutching a cape, said aloud that he was going to quote-unquote destroy some execs on social media. As film Twitter has designated Zack Snyder Stan, you might have guessed that I am a little bit skeptical of this whole story. And indeed, I find it kind of funny that, you know, the author and her sources, they basically make the argument, you know, it was so terrible that he shot scenes without WB's permission during COVID outdoors. Oh, no, think of the unions. Mostly, though, I just felt kind of gaslit by the whole story. Like the suggestion, for instance, that fundraising campaigns for the bus ads or the airplane flyovers weren't crowdsourced, despite having seen those crowdsourced campaigns play out in real time and watching them tick up and being like, wow, they're literally raising tens of thousands of dollars for not only these ads, but also for anti-suicide prevention charities. You know, the suggestion that the number of bots here, which is marginally higher than the average number of bots on any trending topic, reduces the importance of, you know, the real traffic overall is vaguely annoying to me in the sense that, like, it's still 87% real traffic. Like, there's always going to be some fake traffic. That's just how Twitter works, right? But that sensation of gaslighting, the whole, like, oh, I'm being told something that I know is not true, is kind of a hallmark of the whole anti-Snyder Cut campaign in the first place, which went something like this. All right, guys, there's no Snyder Cut, right? That doesn't exist. Well, okay, there is a Snyder Cut, but it's just an assembly print. It's just the assembly cut. Well, okay, actually, there is a director's cut of the film that he had done, but, you know, there was no FX work on it, so it doesn't really count. Well, okay, some of the FX work was definitely done, but it wasn't entirely done. So the final thing that you saw is definitely not the Snyder Cut, so the Snyder Cut never existed. Give me a break! This should go without saying. Look, this should go without saying. I want to reiterate it. Goes without saying. But fans who threatened writers or studio execs for what they wrote about Snyder or the Snyder Cut are awful people, right? And even in the greatest of fandoms, even in the nicest of fandoms, the fandoms that raise, again, tens of thousands of dollars for suicide prevention charities, there will be a toxic element. But I gotta be honest with you, as a guy who's been told to kill himself for reviewing some franchise fare poorly, or has been accused of bigotry for not liking other certain properties, well, I'm unimpressed by the studio executives and their newfound concern about bad fans, right? Like, no offense, you guys, but you have spent the last decade building up these terrible fandoms. And the fact that a director was able to basically take over one of those movements to extract an extra nine figures to finish a movie that lost nine figures in the first place. Hey, who cares if you got a little bit of creative on Twitter with the botnets, right? But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe my Zack Snyder stand-up has blinded me to the facts here. Alyssa, did he go too far?
I mean, in the absence of more dispositive evidence about what happened here, it's hard to say what exactly Zack Snyder did and didn't do. The whole thing seems really ugly, and I will be honest here. I am friendly with Joanna Fuentes, who is the former head of publicity at the WB. I had not known she was being harassed by this. All my experiences with her, especially when she was running things at Showtime, have been positive. My sense is that she's good at her job and a nice human being, and so it was kind of a bummer to me personally to find out that she had apparently been put through the ringer, and I hope she's doing okay. I guess I agree with you theoretically that if Snyder managed to con the studio this way, it's pretty funny, but it's also just hugely embarrassing for Warner Brothers and should be a real sign of what not to do to people at other studios. You know, it's one thing for Snyder to say that, like, they wouldn't have done this if it wasn't a winning financial proposition. I'm not sure I really entirely see the math there, but in any case, I mean, if I were Warner Brothers, I would be very embarrassed about this entire thing and would be reconsidering the way that I think about the internet as a barometer of public opinion or as a guideline of, you know, how my projects are going to perform or what's worth spending money on. You know, I think we're seeing some of that retrenchment in newsrooms, and maybe we'll start to see some of that in Hollywood. It goes without saying that Twitter is not real life, but it can be. If you are dumb enough to allow it to be converted into real life, you may end up making some fairly foolish decisions.
Well, this is the real crux of the issue here. It's funny. I was discussing this with a friend on DM who said, if studios have to make the choice between Twitter being 100% making up their mind and 0% making up their mind, if they have to listen to Twitter entirely or not at all, they should listen to it not at all, because it is not a real place, and it is not representative of any real slice of the American population. But at the same time, it feels very real. When you're getting yelled at by all these people, it feels very real when you're getting harangued and harassed, right? Like, can you ignore something that feels that real?
You would say that as a bot.
As an entire botnet myself.
Yeah, I mean, I think the real revelation here is that Sonny Bunch is a bot, which is weird because I've met Sonny Bunch in person, and it's amazing what bots can do these days. Yeah, the thing here that stands out to me is just the percentage and how much work is being done by the fact that this piece suggests that this is an unusually high amount of bot activity. So the piece says, well, sure, it admits, like, every trending topic has some amount of bot activity, but it's usually something like 3-5%. And in this case, it's 13%. So that's, you know, more than double the usual amount of bot activity. At the same time, the vast majority of Twitter activity, by the account of this piece, is totally legitimate, is totally real. It's not bots being controlled by Zack Snyder or Zack Snyder's forces or minions or whatever, right? Like, this is, and so if we're really saying that extra 8-10% of tweets is what made the difference, then that is just horribly damning for the WB executives, right? That, like, if somehow or another the total amount of, you know, release the Snyder Cut hashtag activity had been reduced by 8-10%, which is what this piece suggests would have happened had there been no allegedly, potentially Snyder-controlled botnet, they wouldn't have spent that money. Like, that margin shouldn't make a difference, and it should, like, on that level of decision. And if it is, then what the hell are the bean counters who make the decisions at Warner Brothers thinking? And so this is why I think it's just a non-issue either way. Is, I mean, you can be mad at Zack Snyder for maybe, you know, using bots here and whatever, misbehaving on Twitter, like literally everyone on Twitter does. Okay, not exactly the way that literally everyone does, but who is, like, a good, besides Alyssa? Alyssa is the only good Twitter user, right? But, like, everybody else is kind of a jackass on Twitter.
I'm the only well-behaved Twitter user. I'm not that entertaining, but I am well-behaved.
And still, that gets you in trouble. I saw you were getting a little bit of a pushback on some stuff this last week on Twitter, Alyssa. I felt bad.
You know,
like,
people just don't know how to take the win. It's fine.
Even good behavior doesn't save you. But this is it's just kind of a non-story, because it seems pretty clear to me it would be crazy to think that was the relevant factor, that somehow or another that small percentage of increased Twitter activity was what crossed the line between spending $100 million and not spending it. Warner Brothers wanted to make this movie because they had evidence that there was fan interest in it, and they also needed to populate the HBO Max service and deliver something that was unique for the HBO Max service. And remember, this was when HBO Max was launching and trying to build an audience.
Was really, really struggling.
You know, and I say this as somebody who thinks HBO Max is the single best streaming service out there today.
Sure,
the one
totally
I use
agree.
The most, and the one that is the best value in terms of what you get. And they were trying to promote the streaming service to a group of people who they understood to be kind of crazed hardcore fans. And like that was that's not a crazy thing to spend $100 million on when you're launching what you hope will be a multi-billion dollar business in terms of a massive streamer that is going to be a, if not the primary revenues driver for your company over the next decade or two.
Listen, I'll come to you in one sec. Here's what because we're talking about numbers here, I want to make this point. Here's what I find interesting about this whole discussion. You know, there's so much talk about the 13% of bots versus 5% of bots, blah, blah. If somebody at WB who has an axe to grind wanted to destroy the narrative that this was an actual thing that people were excited about and was popular, they would release some actual numbers. They would release, we saw a 0% bump in sign-up numbers, or it was only viewed by, I don't know, like 300,000 people.
They would release relevant comparative viewing numbers. Yes.
They would release relevant numbers. And again, the friend I was talking to was like, you know, they said it did about as well as Dune, which was an enormous hit for them. I mean, my understanding is that Dune was basically the most viewed thing on HBO Max when it was released. So I don't know. The suggestion here that the thing didn't work and it didn't do what they wanted and they wasted all this money. Well, maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but I haven't seen any numbers. Either way, Alyssa, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No worries. I think we've been talking a lot about the Twitter stuff and the allegation of bots. I think the more incendiary claim in this article is the implication that Snyder and Ray Fisher sort of orchestrated the timing of his racial discrimination complaints against Joss Whedon in order to put pressure on the studio. Because I think that's quite strongly what's implied in the story.
Oh, yeah. So this is an interesting angle as well. And I do think this is worth talking about here because I read this and I get, like, again, as the reactionary in the organization here, the three of us, our three-person team, I see something like that and I'm like, well, okay, I could, creating a fake race, racial discrimination suit. Sure, maybe that. But at the same time, look, I feel a little icky about a story implying that like Zack Snyder was the puppet master of Ray Fisher, getting him to make up claims of racial discrimination to do his thing.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, from all evidence that has emerged since, like Joss Whedon is a pretty unpleasant person to work with on a lot of levels and is not necessarily fully reckoned with that. And, I don't think the story proves that allegation one way or another. I am not sure the folks at Rolling Stone are quite aware of how that suggestion in the story comes across. But the fact that that is sort of floating around the story suggests just how ugly all of this has gotten. It's a real
yeah,
mess.
And there's another element to this that the Rolling Stone piece I don't think gets into. Maybe it does just briefly, but there was even before Ray Fisher said anything, there were stories in the nerd press about how Joss Whedon had basically cut all of the black characters out of the movie, had cut the Martian
yes.
Manhunter appearance, had cut the Flash's girlfriend. It was played by an African-American actress, cut her out of the film entirely, and replaced them all with, like, a bunch of, like, white Russian guys, basically. I mean, like, this is another thing, like, I was kind of skeptical. I was like, I don't know. And then looking through it piece by piece by piece, I was like, oh, wait, that's actually a pretty compelling case that Whedon has, like, systematically eliminated every African-American character in this movie except for Ray Fisher, whose role was hugely reduced. Whose entire part was gutted. I don't know. I'm sorry to bother everybody with this and to take up so much time on it, but this piece drove me a little bit bonkers. It just drove me a little bit bonkers. On top of all of this, Peter, one reason it drove me bonkers is that nobody would ever take the side of a studio in a dispute like this with any other brand name auteur director. Nobody would be like, we should trust Warner Brothers when it comes to their dispute with Martin Scorsese over the cut of whatever his new movie is, right? What does Scorsese know about what his movie should? Nobody would take a Universal's or Paramount side over Steven Spielberg, right? Like there's a special animus that is aimed at Zack Snyder and his fans, and it's all very weird, and it has always driven me a little bit crazy. And this piece just like put all of that crazy making together in one place for me.
Well, that's not surprising given that you are the Zack Snyder superfan and most of the animus.
Right,
like when you talk
one.
About animus at Zack Snyder's fans, you're talking about animus at Sonny Bunch. And
yes, actually, I am specifically talking about that.
So obviously you take it personally because it was mostly you. And I assume that somehow or another, you're all behind this. I don't know if I do agree that Zack Snyder has a somewhat unique reputation, though I do wonder if. I guess I'm not sure when that happened. Like maybe a little bit of it came after 300, right? And there's always been this sort of sense that 300 is kind of fascist and Frank Miller has bad politics now. And he did that, you know, it was going to be a Batman book, but then like Holy Terror, that it wasn't Batman. It just looks a whole lot like Batman, like just murdering Muslims by the dozen because 9/11 or something. The book was terrible, to be clear. I've reviewed it. And the associations with Frank Miller and Miller's kind of, you know, weird authoritarian politics. Like maybe it was that, but like I do think that some of the backlash to Zack Snyder has come from the relentlessness and obnoxiousness at times of the campaigning for the Snyder Cut. And these things are feeding off of each other. It's not that people just disliked Zack Snyder from the get-go. Maybe they didn't love him, but the way that the campaign for the Snyder Cut was waged has contributed, I think, to a distaste for the director and the fandom around him.
So you're blaming the victim?
Yeah, that's so you're saying that the skirt that the Snyder Cut fans were too short. Is that it?
I'm saying that your bots are all jerks, Sonny.
Well, that's probably true. I mean, look, and again, this is you know, the kind of foundational thing here is that like there are lots of bad people on the internet. There are lots of assholes on Twitter, and like there's never any excuse for threatening or, you know, harassing, et cetera, et cetera. The question is whether or not you paint an entire group with the brush of like the small coterie of dickwads or not. And like, I'm here to tell you that nobody's out there saying like, well, every Star Wars fan is a monstrous bigot because they told me to kill myself because I don't like The Last Jedi. It just is what it is. And like, that's the internet. That is why we are all better off treating Twitter as if it does not exist for purposes of business making decisions.
I do want to object to one thing you said earlier, Sonny, which is that
sure.
You said every fandom has a toxic element. I don't think ours does. Not this podcast.
You should see what happens when somebody says something bad about Across the Movie Aisle. Just waves of hatred and harassment. And
no, I love all you guys. Let's feel the camaraderie.
I'm glad you're ending this on a positive note. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Zack Snyder trolled a major studio into giving him 9 figures to finish a movie that lost 9 figures in theaters? Alyssa?
It's controversial.
Peter?
Either the thing is that happened is a controversy, or the story about it is a controversy, or both. But yes, there's some element of controversy here.
It's definitely a controversy. I just think this is what Michael Mann needs to do to get the director's cut of Black Hat out there. Just hire a botnet and get them to start pinging Legendary and saying, "Hey, release the man cut, release the hacker cut."
8% more tweets.
That's what, if you get 8% more tweets, is my understanding, if you get 8% more tweets, any studio will give any director tens of millions of dollars to finish their film. So get out there and do it. All right, make sure to stop by atma.thebulwark.com on Friday for a special members only bonus episode on alien design in the movies, riffing on our thoughts on Nope. Speaking of which, on to the main event, Nope. The latest feature from Jordan Peele is here, and we're going to be talking about it, which invariably entails talking about the movie, and that means spoilers. So, if you're worried about spoilers, if you haven't seen this movie, and you don't want to hear about what happens in it, you don't want to hear about, you know, aliens and trauma and all that stuff, shut it off now, and we'll be here. We'll still be here when you finally get around to seeing it, so turn it off, come back. All right, now that you've done that. All right, so Nope follows the travails of OJ and Emeril Haywood, played by Daniel Kaluuya and Kiki Palmer, respectively, a pair of siblings who have inherited the Haywood's Hollywood Horses Ranch from their father, who was mysteriously killed by falling debris a few years back. The ranch is in trouble, and OJ has been reduced to selling off horses to the nearby amusement park run by former child star Juke Park, who's played by Steven Yeun in this film. OJ and Emeril aren't sure what to do to save you know, the family business until, that is, OJ is nearly abducted by a UFO one night. OJ and Emerald decide to capitalize on this trauma by capturing an image of the aliens to sell to the world. They need that Oprah shot, right? They want the Oprah shot that they can take on Oprah and be like, hey, everybody, look at this. At first, they try setting up their own cameras, you know, security cams that they pick up from a Fry's Electronics, which I'm not 100% sure exists anymore, but I don't know. And eventually, they bring a famed cinematographer out with a hand-cranked IMAX camera to get the job done, for reasons that aren't really worth getting into. I just love the idea of a hand-cranked IMAX camera. It's very funny to me. Needless to say, things do not go entirely according to plan. Capturing trauma or traumatic elements on film, that's the big idea in Nope. Our societal addiction to filming horrible things and then releasing what we have filmed into the wild, either for clout or for dollars. We see it in the cinematographer. His name is, oh God, what is it? It's Antlers Hulst. We see it in Antlers' obsession with getting good light for the perfect shot of the alien ship, which has negative consequences for him. And a hapless TMZ dork's effort to go viral by getting the shot no one else has. We see it most disturbingly in snippets showing how Jupe's acting career came to an end when a chimpanzee went on a rampage on set and either killed or mutilated his co-stars while the boy hid under a table. Terrified. The thing about Nope is that it looks great, shot by Hoyda Van Hoytema, who is Christopher Nolan's DP on Dunkirk, Interstellar, and Tenet, among other films. And it features great performances, right? Daniel Kaluuya, one of my favorite working actors today, and his simmering stoicism is the most Western thing about this Western sci-fi horror mashup. He is the sort of actor who would fit in with, like, a John Wayne or whoever else, just kind of sitting there going, mm-hmm. But it's just a mess on a storytelling level. This movie's a mess. And to some extent, it almost feels like Nope has the wrong protagonists. Like, I really felt like this should have been Jupe's movie, not OJ and Emerald's. Jupe and his desire to recapture or overcome the horror he experienced as a child. Jupe and the way he has been deformed by that awful moment. It's a frustrating movie because all the disparate elements are great. And the movie itself just doesn't quite cohere into a satisfying whole. By no means did I hate it, but it doesn't work for me either. That said, I'd rather watch an interesting failure, and this movie is an interesting failure, rather than a successful mediocrity. But maybe I'm wrong. Peter, you seem to think this movie is great. How did you come to that insane conclusion?
I loved this movie, and I found myself just totally swept away by its weirdness and its willingness to take what in some ways feels like a kind of conventional summer blockbuster setup and just go strange places with it. This is an alien invasion movie, but it that calls back to a lot of other alien invasion movies, most specifically Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and to some extent even something like E.T. But it's not an alien invasion movie that feels like any other alien film that you've ever seen before. And this movie's sense of independence, I think, is what I like most about it. That and the way that it's a Jordan Peele film. And Jordan Peele, you know, broke out as a director of Get Out, which is this movie that was, I think, rightly praised for its sort of its racial politics or sociological kind of schema. But like since then, he's been making movies that are increasingly complex in the way they deal with their sort of thematic interests, right? And so this is a social issues movie in a bunch of ways, right? It starts with the story of the very first film ever taken, which is a film of a black cowboy, and the idea that we know who shot that film, but we don't know who the black cowboy was. And so this is a movie that is about great imagery and the power of iconic imagery, and it's also a movie about credit. So what's the story about then? It's about a black brother-sister pair who want credit for filming something incredible. And then that's that, right? And that it just and then it absolutely delivers those images to our audience, right? Is this like, here it is. Here are these incredible images, but also because the movie is very interested in trauma and sort of the cost of filming these things, right? And the price that people pay and sort of the in some ways, the violence that's inherent in the production of these incredible images. It's also sort of undercutting and like all of this stuff. And what I love about this movie is that you can't take its theme and reduce it to a single declarative sentence that you could put in on Twitter. And yet it doesn't feel like, man, this movie that just doesn't have any ideas. It's a movie that just doesn't know what it thinks, or it, like, it's a movie that is just sort of underbaked. It feels like a movie that is, there's a line in the review at The Reveal, Substack, great movie Substack, that I recommend, that says the ideas in this movie feel like they're explored. And that's what I like about it, is that each scene is this sort of this sense of exploration where you don't know where it's going, right? It's not predetermined. It's not schematic. It's not like, oh, my goodness, well, we know exactly what this movie thinks about everything, so we're just going to get that in, in some sort of compact dramatic package. Instead, you get a movie where at each point, right, everything, so many of these individual scenes just work like gangbusters. And so often you just have this incredible kind of suspense, humor, right? These like just grandiose images. But as all of this is happening, right? Like, you don't know where it's going at any given point. You don't know exactly how it's going to unfold. And I love that sort of sense of unbalance, of like lack of not knowing, not just in terms of like where the plot's going, but in terms of what does this movie think about the world? What is it trying to tell me? And I just see that so rarely, especially in relatively large budget filmmaking, that is attempting to be crowd pleasing, as this movie is.
Peter, I want to push back on one thing. You say that there's no way to summarize this film in one sentence for Twitter. But again, I just want to go back to my script here for a second. Capturing trauma or spectacle on film. That's the big idea in Nope, our societal addiction to filming horrible things and releasing them into the wild for either clout or dollars.
I think there's a lot more. This is also about...
That's mostly it.
This is also about credit for overlooked Black filmmakers and people who have existed at the fringes of the industry. It is about the power of imagery, the way it sucks people in, literally sucks people in, right? It's about hard work in movies. It's about like the ways that movies take damaged people, right? And force them to pretend that they're not damaged. And I don't know. It's like, I just think there's so much more going on than any sort of 224 characters can give us, whatever the number is.
Alyssa, Sunnybot wants to know what you think.
It's fascinating to me that neither of you have mentioned that this is a movie about humans interacting with animals and the natural world, right? Like, we're talking about this as a movie about filmmaking, but it's also a movie about the mistake of thinking that you can understand wild creatures and that they operate in the same way as you do. And to a certain extent, the most striking thing about the way this movie thinks about aliens is that it treats the alien as fundamentally an animal, right? I mean, this is not some, as far as we can tell, this is not some like, super intelligent scout ship that has come to Earth to prep for an invasion. It's an animal who has decided that the canyon is its hunting territory and that the horses and people in it are its prey, and it's hungry and there's stuff that it can't digest and it wants to scare off predators. And that is also what's true for, Gordy, the chimp who is, who mauled his human co-stars on this set, right? Like, the people who were working with that animal made the sense of thinking that he was on some level not an animal, that he was comprehensible, that he was containable. And part of what's incredibly scary about the climactic sequence where we see Gordy's attack on the other actors on the show from Jupe's perspective is that, you see him be terrified. You see sort of just off screen this horrible attack happening. And it's based on a real chimp attack, too. It's worth noting. The victim in that attack actually ended up went on Oprah in like a veil and gloves in the way that that character is depicted in this movie to like talk about the attack and the sort of limited extent to which facial reconstruction surgery had been successful. But anyway, then Gordy comes back to Jupe and gives him this human gesture, right? He like reaches out for this fist bump. And that's the moment when like the police or animal control or whoever else is able to shoot him and kill him. And so it's, that section of the movie is about this unstable line between, human comprehension and animal incomprehensibility. And, then you also have this running through line in the movie about, what the horses on the ranch understand and to what extent the humans involved can you know, interpret the signs that they're sending about what's happening in the natural environment. And so, you know, I think I admired this movie more than I liked it. Like Sonny, I love Daniel Kaluuya. I think he is just tremendous to watch on screen. He is the rare, I think, contender in this current generation of actors for like real old fashioned movie star, just in the sense that like he does not give performances that like ironize his talent or act ashamed of it in any way. Like he is very fully committed. He plays like really, you know, like masculine old fashioned men in a lot of ways, right? I mean, his character in Judas and the Black Messiah is a revolutionary, but one who is very much grounded in these values of, you know, community and like a sort of masculine care for the community that he's a part of. You know, he is very much this sort of force of order and conformity and tradition in the original Black Panther. You know, he's just a fascinating actor, in part because he doesn't give too much away, in part because he never acts ashamed of what he's doing at all. And so I admired this. I think it's interesting. I think the ending sequence is so sort of gonzo and gorgeous and insane, even sort of within the context of the movie, that I really appreciate it. And yet I don't feel like I emotionally connected to this in the way that maybe you did, Peter.
I very much emotionally connected to it. I think that the animal stuff is fascinating as well. And what is the animal stuff about? In a lot of ways, some ways it's just that, well, have we ever really thought that aliens might be actually understandable only in the way that we understand horses and, chimpanzees, which is to say that we impute these human characteristics to them. And yet,
we impute intelligence and sentience, right?
We think that they perceive the world in a way that is cognizable to us. And it's not that horses that horse perception has absolutely nothing to do with human perception, and yet there is something fundamentally alien about it, right? And anybody who's had an animal that they've been, you know, if you have a dog, even, you realize sometimes like dogs can understand human language. There's often dozens of words, hundreds of words is not completely impossible. And yet dogs are just like operating in some other mental state. And like we've had dogs like hanging out with us doing stuff for 30,000 years or so. And we still are like, what in the world are these things thinking? And so if we met an alien, would it end up being this sort of technological kind of humanoid creature like we always see on Star Trek or even in the Star Wars universe, even something like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where they're basically like we're flying a spaceship. We communicate through sounds, right? Like, the idea of the truly alien is contained within the animal. And this is why I am resisting Sonny's idea that actually this movie is pretty thematically reducible. There are so many different ideas that are being explored here in connected but not totally compacted layers where you can't put it all together. It's a, you know what? And it all just means this one thing. No, it doesn't all just mean one thing. This movie has different ways of looking at the world and is trying to say and do a bunch of different things in a way that I found really impressive and interesting and unusual. And it's also just a great sight sound experience. I mean, this is the sound design in this movie is incredible. It's not just the visuals. It's a movie that I just sort of sunk into. And there was a specific scene when I just bought it completely. And it was the scene in the farmhouse where you initially think that there's like a little green men, right? Like very conventional kind of short aliens invasion. And then it turns out it's just kids pranking him. Now this is a scene that has a long history in horror filmmaking. This is exactly the cat scare from Alien where, you know, oh, you think it's the alien. And it's just, oh no, it's Jonesy. It's just the little cat that Sigourney Weaver keeps on her, her mining ship or whatever it is, her storage or transport ship for whatever
the
reason.
Nostromo.
But the incredible execution there, the fact that Jordan Peele is like, okay, I'm going to give you the conventional alien scare and I'm going to show you that I could do it. That I could make it terrifying. And then I'm going to undercut it and tell you, nope, I'm doing something really different here. The willingness to both engage with the form and also totally break it for the audience just was like, I just found utterly delightful. And he does that so often throughout this movie. It just worked totally for me after that point.
So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Nope? Alyssa?
Thumbs up.
Peter?
Big thumbs up.
Thumbs up. Again, interesting failures better than successful mediocrities. All right, that is it for this week's show. Make sure to swing by atma.thebulwark.com for our bonus episode on Friday. Make sure to tell your friend. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.